If you'd like to listen to our podcasts without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, enhanced show notes for select shows, and more. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or the first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code ECLIPSE to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code ECLIPSE. Thank you very much for your support.
Hello and welcome to the DSR Daily. I'm David Rothkopf, one of your hosts, joined by your other hosts, Chris Cotnoir. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Excellent. And Riley Fessler. How are you doing, Riley?
Pretty good.
Excellent. So, Chris, where do we start?
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken expressed concerns over China's support for Russia's military efforts during extensive talks in Beijing with China's top diplomat Wang Yi. These discussions, part of an ongoing high-level contacts, aimed to mitigate tensions that had previously brought U.S.-China relations to a low point. Despite China's claims of non-involvement in Ukraine's conflict, U.S. officials pointed out indirect support through increased exports to Russia's weapons industry, potentially straining the recently stabilized bilateral ties. Alongside issues like Taiwan, the South China Sea, and China's industrial policies, these topics underscored the complex dynamics and existing challenges in the relationship.
Well, you know, I think you just summed it up just right there, Chris. There are complex dynamics in the relationship. And there are people who want to paint it, you know, as, you know, entirely black and white. You know, in fact, you know, there are books that are coming out now. Our friend Dmytro Perovich has a book coming out. It's real anti-China. David Sanger, our other friend, he has a book out now about, you know, new U.S.-China Cold Wars. Also talks about Russia in the context of the Cold War. And it's just not that simple. It's incredibly complicated, difficult, great power relationship, probably the most complicated one we've ever faced, given that they are absolutely vital to our economic well-being, and we are vital to their economic well-being, 70,000 U.S. companies in China, their being one of our top trading partners, vice versa. And they pose threats in some places, and some places they are a rival. And so I think, you know, everybody's just got to buckle their seatbelts and get ready for a U.S.-China relationship that has its ups and its downs, and hope that you have an administration like the current one that is willing to recognize that's the character of the relationship and not turn every downward motion into a crisis. Or not like, you know, Donald Trump would periodically do, turn every, you know, friendly photo op with a Chinese leader into a love story. This is going to demand the most of our diplomats for many, many years to come. Riley.
Egypt has dispatched a high-level delegation led by its top intelligence official, Abbas Kamel, to Israel with the intention of brokering a ceasefire with Hamas in Gaza. The latest delegation aims to negotiate a new vision for a prolonged ceasefire and initially discuss a limited exchange of hostages held by Hamas for Palestinian prisoners. The talks also aim to facilitate the return of displaced Palestinians in northern Gaza with minimal restrictions. Egyptian officials have expressed concerns about a potential Israeli offensive in the Gaza city of Rafah, which we have mentioned on this show before, as it is close to the Egyptian border, warning that it could lead to catastrophic regional instability.
And that's what everybody's eyes are on right now. The Israelis seem dedicated to going into Rafah. There are talks, or there's rumblings that they're talking about, how do you move a million people? But moving a million people, forced relocation, as violation of their human rights, not moving them and then waging a war that kills a lot of them, violation of their human rights. The Israelis allege there are several thousand Hamas fighters there, not wearing uniforms, hard to distinguish between them and the population, that there are miles of tunnels beneath the area, also makes it hard to fight. And so there's a real question about whether any Israeli initiative, military, would be very effective. You know, there is also the fact that this war, 6 months in, has devastated Gaza, has killed tens of thousands of people, may have killed some number of thousands of Hamas, but hasn't achieved its strategic goals. In fact, there's stories circulating today that Hamas has had an uptick in recruitment precisely for the reasons that you would expect. You know, in addition to the criticism to which Israel is open in terms of human rights violations, it's also open to criticism from Israelis or Americans that wanted Israel to emerge from all of this more secure. They don't seem to be getting there. Chris?
Millions of Indians participated in the second phase of the national elections, with Prime Minister Narendra Modi leveraging his Hindu nationalist agenda to energize his base. The voting round was pivotal for Modi's BJP party. Key candidates in this phase included Rahul Gandhi from the Congress Party, contesting in Kerala, and Shashi Tharoor, along with BJP celebrity candidates like Hema Malini and Aaron Govil. Modi called for high voter turnout, particularly urging young and female voters to participate. The election, which is part of a larger process involving nearly 970 million voters, will determine the composition of India's lower house of parliament, with final results expected on June 4th.
Yeah, you know, Modi's tactics in this election should worry people. He has been anti-Muslim. He has been Hindu nationalist. While he said, you know, he says that that's what it is. This is exactly the kind of campaign targeting the other within a society that you would expect from Trump or Orban or, you know, Putin or Netanyahu, for that matter. This is ethno-nationalism at work. And just like all those other guys, Modi has an agenda that is hardly pro-democratic. So while it may be the biggest election in the world, it may not be a giant step forward for democracy. Riley?
The New York Court of Appeals has overturned the sex crimes conviction of former Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein, ordering a new trial by a narrow 4-3 decision. The court ruled that the inclusion of prior bad acts witnesses in the original trial was improper, as their testimony did not directly establish Weinstein's intent, but rather suggested a propensity for committing the charged crimes. I'm not a legal expert, so I don't really understand the distinction there. Maybe you can shed some light on that, David.
Oh, because I went to law school for 1 year and dropped out.
Yeah. Oh, I can shed some light on that.
Because you watch a lot of Law and Order.
No, because I read a lot about the case and listened to the analysis of why his conviction was overturned.
And what's your insight?
So there were more than 100 potential cases, obviously in the conviction. Two ended up testifying and leading to the conviction of Harvey Weinstein. But New York law prohibits witnesses who are not actually part of the case, nor who were previously part of cases in which Harvey Weinstein was convicted. So that testimony in this particular decision was disallowed. And as horrible as this is, there's some blame to go here on the prosecution, because the women who had testified who had experienced sexual assault, and I don't think there's any denying that at all, also had consensual affairs with Harvey Weinstein, sort of muddying the water. So the prosecution needed to build a stronger case which is why all of these women essentially testified to establish a particular behavior. That's my legal, non-legal analysis.
Excellent legal, non-legal analysis. It makes me want to turn to you for the analysis of the other case of the U.S. justice system being completely fucked up. Why don't you talk about that one?
I feel like the bad guy today.
You're speaking truth to our powerful listeners.
The Supreme Court, in a critical session, appeared ready to reject former President Donald Trump's extensive claims of immunity regarding charges related to attempts to subvert the 2020 election, although their deliberations suggest a likely delay in his federal trial. The justices, both conservative and liberal, grappled with the case's implications for presidential powers and its potential influence on future presidencies. They explored a middle ground that might allow narrow protections for a president's core duties without fully endorsing Trump's claims or opposing argument that former presidents have no immunity for actions taken in office.
I think the idea that there is a middle ground here is where we start to get into trouble. There is nothing in the United States Constitution or in U.S. law that suggests the president has any immunity. In fact, quite to the contrary, the Constitution calls for the president to be impeachable, and it is law and convictable and then prosecutable for things that happen while he is in office. Although it does not by any means suggest that the only way it can happen. And it has long been established, being that this was supposed to be a country that was founded on the idea that no one is above the law, that somebody who was a president, but is no longer, has no immunity at all. But the conservative justices seem to embrace an idea that a president is immune for official acts. Now, first of all, I just want to emphasize that's not anywhere in the Constitution, and it has never been upheld as part of America's legal history. And some acts undertaken while president that seem to use his official offices have already been established to be acts which could be seen to be crimes. Witness the fact that Richard Nixon felt and Gerald Ford felt that Richard Nixon needed to be pardoned. You don't need it to be pardoned if you have immunity. Going further from there, if you listen to this session, you heard Trump's lawyer, when questioned by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, answer that if the president used the military to conduct a coup, that might be construed as an official act. This is when we went kind of through the looking glass. The former president's lawyer was arguing that he would have the ability to use the military of the United States to conduct a coup and not to be held accountable to it by courts of law. Of course, there are other cases where he could use his official powers to commit a crime, like bribery requires that, or abuse of power, which would also then be off the table in this interpretation. Of course, the justices want to present this when this decision comes down, that they were being, and these are the right-wing justices, that they were being moderate, middle of the road, and that they only think presidents have partial immunity, but they're then going to say that the lower court needs to have hearings to determine which of the acts under which that Trump was charged for were official and unofficial. Those hearings will inevitably be drawn out and appealed. And therefore, what you're going to end up with at the end of all of this is the Trump trial for trying to conduct a coup against the United States and for organizing, overseeing a corrupt scheme involving false electors to steal the election, will not come up before the election. And they will have drawn this out. They could have made these decisions in days, not months and months. They will have drawn this out in such a way that Trump, were he reelected, could get his attorney general to simply say, do not prosecute, as he did in the past. And he will never be held accountable for the biggest crime committed by any U.S. official against the United States. Which all draws me to a conclusion. The Supreme Court is broken. Sometimes you think you're going to have a constitutional crisis and it's going to look like January 6th. But the bigger constitutional crisis is the perversion of our highest court and its drift away from its role as it was conceived and its necessary function as the highest level of the judicial arm of the United States government. It's a real crisis. And even if the final decision doesn't look or feel as radical as it could be, what happened yesterday, what has been happening with this court is radical, radical. Remember, all of them, when they got approved for office, said, oh, I won't overturn Roe v. Wade. Under oath to the Congress, they did it anyway. They don't care about precedent. They don't care about history. They twist things to suit their arguments. They give Democratic presidents less power, Republican presidents more power. This is a political hack, corrupt organization. And the final point I will make here is Clarence Thomas should not have participated in that hearing yesterday. His wife is known to have participated in the uprising. In fact, communicating directly with Mark Meadows, who was indicted the day earlier by the state of Arizona for the false elector scheme, it is an absolute outrage. And it is thumbing its nose at any sense of ethics on this court for him to have sat in, asked the first question, and had any role whatsoever in these deliberations. Okay, so I have strong opinions. That's why we're here sometimes. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Riley. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.